The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. Now, I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, before we go to our guest, Mark Faber, today, the oil market is really on everyone's mind right now. It's very volatile. We're starting to see it hit those kinds of numbers that we were seeing a couple of years ago.
Here in the States, we've got West Texas Intermediate above 90. We've got Brent at 108. Kevin, we've got gold, which is up in recent days as much as $40. It's moving above that 1400 level. Silver, impressively, above 34. Kevin, something very significant happening in the metals market, which is worthy of note for all of our listeners. We've been in a trading range with the gold-silver ratio above 45 going back to 1983.
Right.
And we just broke through this last Friday. We're trading at around 42 currently. The question is, will it hold? Will silver maintain its advantage in the marketplace? We want to get an international perspective, not just on the precious metals and commodities today, Kevin, but on a number of things. Our guest has grown up in Europe and has lived for the last 30 years in Asia, so brings certainly an international flavor.
Well, of course, David, this is why we have Dr. Mark Faber on the program today. He's, of course, publisher of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report, and he's always got very insightful ideas as to the way we should be looking at the news right now.
Let's start with Europe and some of the things that are happening specifically in Germany. Hamburg, the elections there, Merkel's party lost, and this was the second major upset following Westphalia last year. We've got the German election in Baden-Württemberg in late March, which, again, we're watching the Christian Democratic Party, that dominance, be relinquished. And clearly the Germans are saying, we're not interested in bailing out the rest of Europe. How does that play into the future of the EU, the strength of the currency, or the strength of the union itself?
Well, basically, I'm not a political expert about European matters, and you should ask a politician about these issues. But in general, the point is simply this. The German public is probably not particularly happy about the fact that Germany bails out the pigs. In other words, Portugal, Ireland, Iceland, and so forth and so on. And so there is great opposition to Germany being part of the EU and Germany supporting governments, including Greece, that has basically abused the system by not maintaining fiscal restraint.
Well, it seems that the pressures remain for Europe. The debts remain for the individual countries, as you mentioned, Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. And as long as the debts remain, the issues of whether it is insolvency or fiscal pressures are a real burden still yet to bear. What we'd like to also look at is the U.S. equities market. The developed world has had a decent run in prices since March of 2009, and the emerging markets have not done as well, relatively speaking. Maybe you can speak to overvaluation and undervaluation vulnerability in the equities markets.
Well, basically, we didn't have a decent run. We had a fantastic run. The S&P has doubled, and in emerging markets, we had price increases that are far better than a doubling of the indices. And in general, emerging economy stock markets since 2003 have way outperformed the S&P. So we had unbelievable moves in markets. In the U.S., we only had on two previous occasions a move such as we had in the last 27 months from 666 on the S&P to over 1,300. And that was in 1934, coming of a major low when the market had declined by 90% between 1929 and 1932. And then another move into between 1934 and 1937, and that was then followed by renewed extreme weakness in the market. So basically, stocks have done fantastically well, and I was fortunate to be relatively positive about equities between October 2008 and March 2009. But if someone had said to me, well, do you think the S&P will double? I wouldn't have expected a doubling. I would have thought the market will rebound maybe by 40-50%, but not a doubling. And so the markets in the world between March 2009 and today have done actually much better than anybody had kind of expected. And starting in November 2010, the emerging markets started to weaken. And I think that eventually the U.S. will also follow, that we have just begun a more significant correction in the U.S., whereby I accept the fact that international investors overweighted emerging economic stock markets until recently and underweighted the U.S., and now money is flowing back into the U.S. But whether that is the right strategy, I have second thoughts. I think emerging stock markets will go down further, but I wouldn't, because of that, buy the U.S. I would probably just stay out of the U.S.
Well, as you look at the cyclically adjusted price-earnings ratio for the S&P, it recently hit 24, which is very similar to what we saw in 1928, very similar to what we saw at the market peak in 1937, and also in the massive bull market run up until 1966, where valuations were clearly overdone. But what that implied was underperformance for a number of years following, not necessarily a cataclysmic collapse, but certainly underperformance. So if investors are expecting healthy rates of return in equities over the next 10 years, it would certainly be difficult to argue for that based on the cyclically adjusted price earnings multiples. What you're suggesting is that emerging markets and developed markets, developing world markets, are really in the same boat, which would imply that the whole concept of decoupling is not necessarily one that you would agree with?
Well, no. I mean, I think that there will be some decoupling, and whenever you look at the market, different sectors perform differently, but generally speaking in the same direction. So if someone took a very bearish view about emerging stock markets, I don't think he should go into European stocks or U.S. stocks. I take a more balanced view. I think we're in a money printing environment. If something happens in China, they'll print even more than the U.S. printed. If something happens in Europe, they'll also print money. They're going to print money everywhere. And with interest rates essentially on short-term deposits zero or below zero, inflation adjusted, in other words, the inflation rate everywhere in the world is larger or is higher than the interest rates on short-term deposits, I think for the investor, the question is really, how do I invest my money for the long term? And I think that you can't make a very bullish case for stocks, but I think you can make a more bullish or more positive case for stocks than, say, for U.S. government bonds, because the deficits in the U.S. will stay very high and the quality of the debt will diminish and the interest payments as a percent of the tax revenues will go up and so forth and so on. So if you believe in, let's say, an economic recovery and world growth, or if you believe in disaster, in either case, you're probably better off in equities than in bonds. And in terms of returns, I agree with you. I don't think that the returns will be fantastic. But if you print money, it's just very difficult to say what the returns will be, because it's not stocks that adjust on the downside, but it's the currency that adjusts on the downside. And so in theory, it is possible that the Dow could double if you print money, or even could go up 10 times, depending on how much money you print. And with Mr. Bernanke at the Fed, I think it's quite likely that a lot of money will be printed.
Well, and that is a critical observation, that what's happening is really a degradation of global currencies. And certainly we saw that in Germany in 1919 to 1923, where the German stock market went up nearly 14 times, yet in terms relative to gold, still diminished significantly. So it was a better bet than buying German bonds or sitting in German marks. On the other hand, it was still a relative loser, you could say. I guess one of the critical issues today for investors is existing in a world of negative real rates of return, where you have both an increase in taxation, that's a potential, but the reality of money printing and inflation, which strip away any of your real returns, with interest rates being as low as they are, isn't this one of the drivers into commodities and into assets like gold and silver? Because frankly, you're looking at negative real rates of return otherwise?
Well, basically, an investor has the choice to invest in real estate, in equities, in bonds, in commodities. And I separate precious metals from commodities, from industrial commodities and the soft and the agricultural ones, because I consider it money. And also we can buy art and stamps and other collectibles and so forth. And if you came to me and said, look, the interest rates are at zero at the present time, and I have a large subscriber base for my gloom, boom, and doom report, and I asked each one of them to let me know if they have the impression that the cost of living increases, in other words, the percentage of how much they pay every year more for their family is less than 5%. So far, I haven't received a single email. So I think inflation is around 5%. The returns on deposits is essentially zero. And then people begin to worry because the money, paper money, is no longer a store of value. At the same time, it's a bad unit of account because it's debased by the central bank. So people buy paintings, they buy real estate, they buy stocks, they buy, to some extent, bonds. Last year, we had large inflows into bond funds, and they buy precious metals. The problem with all this easy monetary policies and artificially low interest rates is that not everything goes up at the same time. In other words, we had a bubble in the Nasdaq 1997 to March 2000. And then the bubble burst. Then we have a real estate bubble, 2000 to 2006. And then between September 2007 and July 2008, oil goes from $78 to $147, and the CRB goes ballistic, so we had a commodities bubble. In 2008, everything collapsed. Oil, in an unprecedented move, went from July 2008 from $147 to a low of $32 in December 2008. In other words, in 6 months, oil fell from $147 to $32 a barrel. And these kind of moves are brought about by the Federal Reserve's monetary policies. And for the investor, there's no point to be overly dogmatic. 1999 to 2007 and 2008, gold outperforms equities by a huge margin. Also, silver outperforms equities by a huge margin. 2009, equities outperform gold. And from here onwards, it's going to be the same pattern. There will be suddenly other assets that appreciate and some assets go down. I happen to think that bond prices will go down, but they have become oversold on a near-term basis because over the last 3 months, the whole world became overly enthusiastic with the inflation trade. And the thinking was government bonds are bad and equities are good. And so that may reverse for a little while. But I think long-term, you know, if you look at 10 years, one of the worst investments will be a long-term U.S. government bond.
What measures might the Fed and the Treasury employ to defend the bond market, as it is so critical to the financing of our deficits and our way of life in America?
Well, basically, I think they don't necessarily want to support the bond market, but because the debt issuance is so huge, they almost have to monetize part of the debt. I mean, I read Treasury reports about 2010 by Tim Geithner, signed. The U.S. government debt increased by more than $2 trillion during that period of time. And the deficit, in my opinion, mathematically cannot come down because 80% of the budget is mandatory expenditures. In other words, you can't cut them. They are legally, they have to be met. And of the remaining 20%, you can cut a little bit, but not that much, because then services collapse and this and that. So I think the deficit, in my view, the fiscal deficit of the U.S. will stay around $1.5 trillion for as long as the eye can see, and maybe even go to $2-2.5 trillion. And then the interest expenditures on the debt go up. So actually, over time, in my view, unless taxes are increased significantly and spending is cut significantly, not by a little bit here, a little bit there, the budget will never again be balanced. And that will then necessitate, in time, QE3, QE4, QE5. Now, taxes can't be increased dramatically, because if you increase them very substantially, we go straight back into a recession.
But it seems like perhaps one of the best strategies that they have to employ is a manipulation of the CPI numbers so that people assume that real-world inflation is 2 to 2.5% while running at a 5% rate, essentially cutting your debts in half over a long enough period of time. If real-world inflation is, as John Williams of Shadow Stats has said, closer to 8%, then we are alleviating a lot of our existing stock of debt at a rapid rate.
Correct, correct. But you understand, you're not really helping the economy. You're impoverishing, let's say, the honest people that are decent, that have deposits, that save money and keep it in the banking system, that simply don't want to speculate. So it's a tax on people's savings. And it's a very vicious tax because it's not so obvious to them. But it will become one day obvious when with their money they can buy less and less. In other words, the purchasing power of money goes down. That's why I'm telling everyone, if you already own cash, consider gold and silver to be a component of your cash portfolio and own some of it, because that's the only cash that government, they can expropriate it, but otherwise they can't fiddle around with it in terms of increasing the supply.
You made that distinction earlier that precious metals you don't put in the same category as commodities in general because you consider it money. Is that only the case when money that we're used to, here in the U.S., U.S. dollars, in Thailand, the baht, where money loses its moneyness? Is that the environment where you treat precious metals as a cash alternative?
Yes. And also, I would say, let's take a very bearish scenario. Assuming there is a collapse in the Chinese economy, which is not necessarily my prediction, but some people say it's a horrendous bubble. I agree, if you define a bubble as artificially low interest rates and excessive credit growth, then we have a colossal bubble in China. But it may go on for another 2-3 years. But let's say it breaks one day. Then it will have a very negative impact on the demand for industrial commodities. And we may get at that stage in some sectors of the economy a whiff of deflation. In other words, the demand for industrial commodities could for a year or two decline. And so obviously the price of copper and of nickel and also to some extent oil, whereby oil will depend very much on political development, would go down. In that environment, there will be more money printing. You know, it's the same. If the S&P drops 20%, all the people that are now criticizing Mr. Bernanke for QE2, they'll go back to their old pattern as they have done between 1980 and 2007 to encourage the Fed to print money because they all benefited from rising asset prices. So as soon as the S&P drops 20%, the American policymakers will all again be for further monetary measures, policy measures, and further fiscal measures. And at that time, obviously, you could end up with an economy that is very, very weak, global economy that is very weak, but where prices go up for certain commodities, such as gold and silver. But they go up not because of shortages or they don't go up or they don't go down because of oversupply situations, but they move because they are a safe currency. They are then, they become the proper unit of account. In all hyperinflation economies, eventually people give up their own currencies as a unit of account. Like, you go to Zimbabwe during the hyperinflation, you go to Germany during the hyperinflation, Mexico during the hyperinflation. Nobody anymore calculated prices in their domestic currencies. It was all then becoming a dollar standard or a gold standard. And that's why I think that people should have some of their money in gold and silver.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com.
Let me ask a question about silver, because this is a bit of a tricky juncture. From 1983 to the present, we've seen the gold and silver prices fluctuate in a relationship between 100 to 1 on the high side down to 40 to 1 on the low side. And you'd have to go back to the 1960s and 70s to find a different pattern of behavior where those metals favored silver even more greatly and the ratio traded between 20 and 50. Are we in a transition back to that earlier period where silver perhaps continues to outperform? And as a part of that question too, let me throw in China into the mix. You mentioned the possibility, not that it's your position, that we will see a collapse in China, but if that were to happen as a result of rapid credit expansion, cheap capital, you know, large-scale fraud, the incentives that have been there to ignore risk, if we do see a collapse in China over the next 2 to 3 years, does that impact silver negatively because of its industrial component, or is that such a marginal factor when gold and silver are being treated as money?
Well, first of all, I think that gold and silver will move in the same direction. But as I tried to explain earlier on, when you print money, essentially everything goes up, but at different times and with different intensity. And in a bull market, usually towards the tail end of the bull market, silver tends to grossly outperform gold. So, yeah, maybe it will outperform gold. But I stick to gold because my safe deposit box is not large enough to put enough silver in it, whereas it is large enough to put enough gold in it. So, you know, different people have different preferences. And my friend Eric Strutt, who knows the silver and gold market extremely well, he thinks that silver will go ballistic. So maybe, yeah, that's true, but I don't think that silver would go up alone without gold also moving. So the direction will be the same. And concerning China, yes, I suppose that silver would have a larger industrial component than, say, gold. But as I pointed out, if China collapses and there is a huge deflationary scare, I suppose that the real industrial commodities like copper and nickel and so forth, they would be more vulnerable than gold and silver.
Well, coming back around to the U.S. markets, we've seen for at least 12 months now record insider selling, and that's been very pronounced at your banks starting in about November of 2009, where there's been a disproportionately high degree of selling by insiders as opposed to buying. Would you combine that with other indicators, you know, liquidations from bear funds?
I'd just like to say about the insider selling, this is also something that I follow and that concerns me. But having said that, and being on the board of different companies, let me explain to you what happens. Let's say I'm on the board of a company and I get stock options. Then I exercise the stock options, and then to diversify, I may sell some of the shares I own in that company through my stock option plan, and then I may go and buy other stocks in the market or make other investments. So because of the proliferation of option plans in the last, say, 20 years or so, there is a natural tendency that when a CEO sells shares, it is reported. But when he invests with a hedge fund manager or buy shares in other companies, it's not reported. So I think there has been a change in the validity of the statistics. But I agree with you. At the present, the ratio is so huge between selling and buying that it's a rather negative indicator. Then when you combine that with other indicators that are also negative, a hugely overbought market, and so forth, I think some caution is in order.
Well, to look at the end of our conversation today, one of your recent reports you titled, "The End Game Has Begun." What would you suggest is the end game? Are we talking largely about the credit markets, interest rate reversals, and an end to the shenanigans that have been played for 30 to 40 years in those credit markets? What is your area of greatest concern, and what would be some practical things that investors can do in these harrowing transitions?
I mean, I think we're all doomed. I think what will happen is that we are in the midst of a kind of a crack-up boom that is not sustainable, that eventually the economy will deteriorate, that there will be more money printing, and then you have inflation and a poor economy, so an extreme form of stagflation. And eventually in that situation, countries go to war, and then the whole derivatives market and everything will collapse. And like your computer, when it crashes, you will have to reboot it. And so for the investor, the question is, how do I navigate through this complete disaster that is going to unfold? And I think if you look at different asset classes, real estate, equities, bonds, cash, precious metals, I suppose that you have to be diversified. I think real estate in the U.S. may go down another 10% or so, or even 15%, but I'm always telling people, if you can buy the piece of land or the house you like, what do you actually care it goes down another 10%? If everything I bought in my life had only gone down 10, 15%, I'd be very rich, because a lot of things became worthless, especially loans to friends and bonds and so forth. And if I look at the history, say, of Germany, for the last 100 years, they have World War One. They had the hyperinflation and World War Two. The bondholders, they got wiped out 3 times. If you own Siemens, and you still own Siemens today, it wasn't a fantastic investment, but at least you still have something. You weren't wiped out. And so I think that in equity, you will be better off because you have an ownership in a company than by being the lenders to companies and the lenders, especially to government.
Do you anticipate an entry point into equities that perhaps rivals what we saw in 1932 or perhaps 1949 or more recently 1982 as we launched into a massive bull market? Do you anticipate seeing values even remotely close to that?
Well, as I said, in a money printing environment, it's very difficult to know what is actually cheap and what is expensive. Is the price of wheat high or is it low? Inflation adjusted, it is extremely low. In nominal terms, it's relatively high. I believe that actually in March 2009, when the S&P was at 666, the market was actually much cheaper than it's generally perceived because of the money printing. And I don't anticipate that we will see 666 on the S&P again in nominal terms. In other words, they're going to print so much money that the S&P could be, I don't know, at 2,000. But in real terms, it could be down below the lows of March 6, 2009. In other words, maybe in gold terms, we could one day reach a ratio Dow Jones to gold of 1-to-1 as we were in 1980. In other words, the Dow could be, say, at 10,000 or 12,000 and gold could be at the same level. So that's why I'm advising people to accumulate gold. Now, can gold have a correction? Yes, there has been a little bit too much euphoria about gold and so forth and so on, and we may have a correction. But I don't think we're in a bubble in the price of gold. In fact, I could make a case that gold at this level of $1,400 an ounce is cheaper than in 1999. When I look at the unfunded liability growth of the U.S., at the credit growth of the U.S., and at the household debt growth and so forth and so on, and at the money printing, and at all the wealth creation that happened in China and in Russia and so forth and so on. Just consider, when I started to work in the 70s, one said there were two billionaires in the world. One was Rockefeller and the other one Mr. Ludwig. Then in 1980, there were, I think, 6 or 8 billionaires. Now you have thousands of billionaires. It's just that paper money has become of lower value. And in that environment, it's conceivable that actually stocks don't go down a lot in nominal terms, but they go down inflation adjusted. And not inflation adjusted by what the government is publishing, but in inflation adjusted terms, as John Williams points out, he says inflation is running at, say, 8% per annum. I have it slightly lower, depending also on the household, whether you have children or no children, where you live. But I would say between 5 and 10% in America is probably a realistic figure, and between 8 and 12% in countries like India, China, Vietnam is also realistic.
Well, thank you for joining us today. We look forward to touching base with you perhaps later in the year for your insights, and they're particularly welcome with an international emphasis. You've lived in Asia for a long time. We'll have some questions perhaps as we move into the summer months, specifically on China, as we explore some of the issues relating to that particular market. You've been writing on that since 2004 in your book, Tomorrow's Gold, and want to unpack that with you a bit more in a future program. But thanks for joining us today.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Have a good night.
Well, David, as always, that was a fascinating interview with Dr. Faber. Something that he brought out that I thought was fascinating, we look at things in nominal value in cash, but in reality, we've talked over and over with people to let them know that they need to be dividing the value of something in something that would be what Dr. Faber termed a proper unit of account. And he said he thinks gold will be the proper unit of account.
Kevin, it's been that classically, but I think that point is so critical, because as we discussed with Dr. Faber today, it's being in a money printing environment that distorts all realities. You really don't know what you have in equities. You really don't know what you have in real estate. You really don't know what you have in bonds or cash deposits. These things become really irrelevant if you're still looking at your monthly statements or going through a personal balance sheet and coming up with nominal figures. And that's a real challenge, Kevin, to shift your thinking to real terms. But it's absolutely critical if investors want to walk through the next 5 to 10 years relatively unscathed.
Well, David, something that'll really make you stop and ponder, he did say that gold at $1,400 today is still cheaper than it was in 2009, when it was hundreds of dollars less than it is, just given the amount of money that's been printed.
Kevin, as I go back through sort of his worst-case scenario step sequence, it really does follow a similar pattern to what we've discussed in general terms, financial crises becoming economic, becoming political, becoming geopolitical, wherein stagflation leads to an environment where individual countries focus on their individual problems to the exclusion of the rest of the world, and world trade suffers as a result. That's an environment that's ripe for conflict, war. And when you look at, we didn't get a chance to discuss with him, Kevin, but when you look at the recent merger of the German Bourse and the New York Stock Exchange, it's interesting that this creates the largest derivative clearinghouse in the world. And the profits of both bourses, when you're looking at derivatives traded, come primarily from trading in derivatives and not the underlying products. In other words, if you're looking at the volume of stocks traded on the New York Stock Exchange, it now is trivial by comparison to the profits generated from hybrid products
that don't really even exist, to be honest with you, David. They're not real.
They're loosely connected to those real companies. So, Kevin, it's just bizarre when you think about some of the best companies in the world, whether it is a Nestle, whether it's a Procter & Gamble, whether it's an Intel, the derivative products and investment themes that surround it actually are more important today in the financial world than that product itself. That is a clear distortion, Kevin, a clear distortion of where Wall Street has gone and where the financial markets have gone, but it also speaks to how dangerous these markets are, and he suggests that at the tail end, wherein you have a collapse in the derivative market because it truly is the greatest fiction we're living with today.
Well, you know, it reminds me of smaller fictions that we've been through in the past, David. I mean, in the late 1990s, we started to see this tech stock boom get to the point where companies that didn't produce a profit or a single product were worth more than United Airlines because it had .com behind the name. Now, that was false. That collapsed, okay? And then talking about derivatives, remember, just a couple of years ago when we were having the show, when we saw that the derivatives market combined with the commodities and currencies and equities passed $250 billion. Okay, that was unfathomable. Then, of course, we had the collapse.
Well, you stack that number against the roughly $1 trillion that is available at any price in the gold market, and you can realize that when things come unglued, now that includes the derivatives market as well, just financial securities, the real stuff in the financial securities markets, stocks and bonds, is over $200 trillion. But again, relative to such a small, minute space. And I think one of the things that he mentioned, Kevin, today is a critical reminder that gold and silver are more and more being treated as currency rather than a commodity. And that takes place particularly in those countries that are experiencing currency crises to some degree. He mentions India, China, and Vietnam experiencing inflation rates of between 8 and 12%, and our inflation rate in the U.S. being somewhere between 5 and 8. Is it any wonder, Kevin, that people look at their options and say, this just doesn't smell right? This just doesn't smell right. I think I'm opting for a currency alternative.
You know, and the other thing that's amazing is, look at how few people still are actually saying that. We've talked about this over the last couple of weeks, how few people are actually participating in the only market, actually, David, that's protecting them from this inflation.
He mentions in his most recent report, the Gloom, Boom, and Doom report, that he's spoken to a group of hedge fund managers in Singapore, a group of private investors in South Korea, over 1,000 people, and then very man-on-the-street type investors in Switzerland.
Even Switzerland. Yes.
About 1,500 of them. And in each instance, in a room full of, you know, over 1,000 people, only 3 to 5 people would raise their hands when asked the question, do you have any allocation to precious metals today? So it is surprising, Kevin, these cross currents of, is gold and silver in a bubble? Who's participating in driving it higher? The classic reality, Kevin, when you're dealing with a bull market and its bubble dynamics, is that the bull market ends when the last person who has capital and interest can actually come into the market. And the reality, Kevin, is we are so far from that. When you look at the stock of capital that exists in the world today, the theme today, money printing, impacting all financial markets in disproportionate ways. Kevin, there's a lot of money and a lot of people who haven't even once considered the precious metals market. But I think, Kevin, that we're on the cusp of that changing.
You know, that makes gold still the best-kept secret in the world. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Dr. Mark Faber. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or just give us a call, 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.